This is 1988 Tops, where every card has a story to tell. Your hosts are David McKellis and Matt Kuzma. Let's play ball. Welcome back to 1988 Tops. David, what's our card for this week?
Our card this week is card number 714, Jim Fregosi, manager of the Chicago White Sox.
All right. Jim Fregosi, looking forward to this one, and we have a guest.
We have with us Mark Armour, and Mark is the founder of Sabres Baseball Card Committee, as well as founder of Sabres Biography Project, to which we owe a lot of thanks for the success of this podcast. Mark's also the current president of Sabres Board of Directors since 2019, and he wrote the Sabre bio about Jim Fregosi, along with multiple books about baseball, edited a few books about baseball. Most recently, he wrote Intentional Balk, Baseball's Thin Line Between Innovation and Cheating, along with co-author Dan Levitt. And this year, Intentional Balk won Sabre's Seymour Medal for the best book of baseball history, published in 2022. So welcome, Mark, to the show.
I really appreciate you having on. You guys do good work.
I appreciate that. And I also recently saw that you were on GQ Sports talking about cheating in baseball. We've talked about a couple guys who maybe ended up in GQ with Kirk McCaskill and Mark Chardy, but never actually talked to somebody who was featured in Gentleman's Quarterly. Any particular favorite incidents that folks might not know about that are featured in the book or that you talked about with GQ?
Well, so the book is about the history of cheating sort of from soup to nuts. And I guess if there's an overriding theme of the book, it is that baseball players and people associated with baseball, meaning managers, general managers, et cetera, are incredibly competitive people, very successful people. And I think those are the kinds of the people that are likely to always be looking for an edge. And that edge could be figuring out how to give under the table bonuses to players before there was a draft, or it could be throwing a spitball, or it could be stealing signs, or it could be taking performance-enhancing drugs. I mean, the cheating scandals that have come up through time have been more about opportunity than they are about the ethics of the generation of men that happen to be playing at this time. Groundskeepers over the years have done things like water down infields when the other team has a lot of base stealers. And some of those stories became somewhat comical. You know, people have adjusted the pitcher's mound for their pitchers. And spitballers, I think, have been kind of amusing over the years. Certainly when I was a kid, the Gaylord Perry was amusing. Maybe people aren't as amused anymore about somebody putting sticky stuff on his fingers. It's kind of the same thing, but it's, I think, part of it is the efficacy of the problem. You know, how much we believe it's changing the game in a way we don't want. With social media and everything, I think we're just much more scolds than we were before. I mean, certainly more than when I was a kid. And I assume that that is modified throughout the years as well.
And I think even something like the banging scheme, if that had not been a team that won a World Series, if that had just been a silly thing that was done and didn't have that impact and actual success connected with it, I think it would be much more of a laughing matter than people take it, and now with booing the Astros everywhere they go.
Yeah, they boo players that weren't even on the team at the time. It's very, yeah, I mean, I completely agree. The key problem the Astros had is that they're honestly one of the best teams we've seen in the last 25 years was that team. Not to get off the track for the question you asked, but they were a very good team before they started the scheme, and they were a very good team after they stopped, which doesn't say that they didn't cheat. But I think it should instruct us in terms of like how much it actually helped them.
I did search through the book to see if there were any references to Jim Fregosi. I did not find any. But we do have a connection here because along with writing all these books, you also were the founder of the Sabre Bio Project. We've used this for multiple episodes. I think there are thousands of bios done. The effort is to get every player done. You've done, by my count, 76 of these, including some big names, Johnny Bench, Gaylord Perry, Orlando Cepeda, Joe Cronin, who you also wrote a book about, and three guys in the 1988 top set, all of them managers, and one of them is Jim Fregosi. What made you pick Jim Fregosi as a compelling figure for you to write a Sabre bio about?
76 seems like a lot. And I guess it is. I had a period of about, I'm going to say it was probably 10 years ago, where I decided I wanted to get back into writing biographies. I think my Joe Cronin book had just come out. And I decided that I wanted to tackle like some of the better players from my childhood that had not been covered. And I went on Baseball Reference. I sorted this 20-year period by war to see like who were the actual best players. And I would just stop when I got to somebody that I thought was interesting. That's how I ended up with Cepeda, and that's how I ended up with some Frank Howard. I did all three of the Alous, which it turns out is a big advantage because part of the thing you need to do with a person is to figure out what their childhood was like. And with the Alous, I got all their childhoods at once. So I had this sort of advantage. But anyway, in the case of Fregosi, he was an extremely good player, and I think that's been lost. And he was a very good player when I was just starting to follow baseball, and he didn't remain a good player for very long. I missed most of his best years. But when I was a kid, he was starting the All-Star game. Like 1970 was, I think, the last time he was in the All-Star game. And I certainly would have watched that game. And he's famous for other reasons now. But I think that his excellence has been a little bit lost to history.
I remember Fregosi because when I was coming into my baseball fandom, he was the manager of the Chicago White Sox, my favorite team. And he was bigger by then and didn't really look like a guy who would be an all-star shortstop by that point in his life. Only later in adulthood did I learn, oh, this guy, not only was he a good player, but with a few extra great seasons, he would have been a Hall of Famer based on war value. I found him to be a compelling figure because of those stats and because of his status as the White Sox manager during some lean times. And so appreciate your work on that Sabre bio and with the bio project.
Let's go to the front of 714 and pull up the front of this card. Jim Fregosi looks very tan here. And he's wearing, David, I think the best Sox logo around with the little guy with the bat on his shoulder. This is an awesome jacket. Do you have one of these jackets?
I do not. I have put off buying one of these, but this is the only instance of that logo in the set because at this point they had switched to the script C. We've seen the block letter Sox warm-up jersey, which was from the previous iteration of White Sox uniforms, but we haven't seen the little man with the bat. And this was used as the team's logo from 1976 to 1990. A very cool jacket. I do like that. Yeah, he's 45 years old in this picture. We did just reflect on the fact that Jim Leland and Tony La Russa in this set were the same age that I am now. And Jim Leland was perpetually 75 years old. He's an old 45 in this.
He was, you know, a great player until basically 1970, and he got really old really fast. And, you know, I can be accused sometimes of thinking that you can learn everything from baseball cards. You don't really need anything else. And this is an example of that. So if you look at Jim Fregosi's baseball cards from the 1960s, he's chiseled, right? He looks like an athlete on these photos. Apparently he was. He played other sports, and he could do everything on the baseball field. He was fast. He was a good defender. He could hit. However, if you look at his cards from the mid-70s especially, he looks like he's 30 pounds heavier. No kidding. If you look at his, say, 1971 card, he's a shortstop on the card. And he's actually playing defense on the card. And then by, like, 74, he's in the third base, first base stage. And then soon he's, like, DH first base. And he's still, like, 33. And he looks sort of haggard. I later discovered that he was always a drinker. I mean, social drinker. I don't want to make it sound like he was, you know, drunk all the time, but he was a social drinker, partier, eater. And yeah, 45. I mean, he looks like he could be 65 in this picture.
Let's go to the back of 714. And we, as usual, have for the manager cards, the team checklist on the back. So we have the Chicago White Sox and all of the players that are in the set. And then also the stats, manager Jim Fregosi, height 6'2", weight 205, right-handed batter and thrower, born April 4th, 1942 in San Francisco, California, with a home in Sarasota, Florida.
It is striking that this White Sox team, aside from Harold Baines and Carlton Fisk, was not very good. Their pitching staff was pretty terrible. Young Bobby Thigpen, Richard Dotson, Floyd Bannister were the standouts there. They finished 77 and 85. They were not very good at all during Jim Fregosi's time there. Notable, he is listed at 205. He was 190 during his playing career. Might be generous, is what
it may be generous, yeah.
One difference between the traded set manager cards and the regular set, in the traded set, you have Frank Robinson, and you have his playing stats on the back of his card. On this one, you have the team checklist. In the traded set, they don't have the team checklist. They have both playing and managing stats, which is probably more interesting than the team checklist. And that probably might have told me more about Jim Fregosi, the player, when I was an eight-year-old looking at this baseball card. Mark, you told me that you really liked the 88 top set, which is something that we don't hear a lot from folks, even listeners of the podcast. Particular favorite things, favorite cards in the set?
I started collecting cards like in the late 60s. I was born in 1960. So in the 80s, when there was a boom in the sense that suddenly we had three sets to collect. But fortunately for me, it came along at a time when I could afford, right? Cards weren't as expensive back then, right? You could put a set together for $30 or something, or you could buy the set for $12. So it was very easy for me. I had a job and everything to sort of keep up with what was going on. And I was, you know, unlike a lot of my peers, I didn't give up collecting baseball cards when I was 12 years old and move on to girls like my friends did. I actually secretly continued to keep my cards. Well, so in the 80s, I was sort of, you know, buying the cards and everything. And 88 might have been near the end of a time that I would actually buy the pack. I would actually go in. And my recollection is that because the three companies at the time, and four soon, Score came out that year, were competing with each other, one of the ways they did that was the cards came out earlier and earlier and earlier. I remember buying boxes of 1988 cards, so I'm 27 at the time, and they were available like in January. So like in January, it's like pitch black, snow on the ground where I lived in Boston. And I'm like buying like a couple of boxes of these cards and putting the set together, which I did. So a couple of things I really liked about it. I think it's probably my favorite set that Topps did in a multi-year period. I didn't like 87. That's really popular. I wasn't really a big fan of that. What I like about this, I love the fact that the teams are color-coded. That happened a lot when I was a kid, and I think that some of your priorities, you know, come when you're 10. This is the way cards are supposed to do. I always sorted my cards by team. The fact that every White Sox card had a green border and green letters, I think that was great. So it's very easy to do. I like cards that are fairly simple in the sense that they don't have like this ostentatious bordering or whatever. And I think this card with a simple border, you know, picture of the dude and not a lot of text, that's kind of my sweet spot for what cards should look like. And I think this is a good set. I really enjoyed it. I think now looking back in 2023, we tend to judge sets by how much they're worth, right? And the 88 card is not really held up. But I do believe truly that if there was a way to take that information out of our brains and just like actually look at sets sort of independently of that, I think a lot of people, if you just show these to non-baseball card people, would look at this 88 set differently than I think we tend to do now. I think my favorite card at the time, I can tell you, at being a Red Sox guy, I was really excited about the cards of Ellis Burks and Mike Greenwell, because as you know, it's really cool to, if you collect cards, to see a card of a guy that has never had a card before. And Burks was a rookie. He didn't get a card the year before. He might have been in the traded set. I don't remember, in 87. I love his card. I look at the card now, even though I had not looked at it in 30 years until I pulled it out the other day. I looked at the card and I said, yes, I remember how I felt when I opened this pack and saw this card. Ellis Burks. Loved him. But my favorite card, Red Sox aside, is the Barry Bonds card. He looks so handsome. He's smiling. The light on his face is perfect. I actually like portrait cards, like they're just a portrait, but they have to be lit well, and they also, the person can't be, you know, like grimacing or whatever. But if they actually look like they're glad to be there and they caught Bonds at a really good time, and of course, you know, finding pictures of Bond smiling later in his career was very difficult.
I hadn't looked at that in a while. Thanks for bringing that up. That's a great card. Someday we'll talk about him. I imagine people are interested in hearing about that guy.
Yeah, nobody ever talks about him.
Yeah, not enough. The back of this card has Jim Fregosi's biographical materials. Born in San Francisco, raised about 20 miles south of there in San Mateo. His parents were Archie and Margaret. They owned a grocery store. Jim's earliest memories were of his father going to the store at 4 a.m. Little Jim would go help bag groceries. San Mateo was a city of around 20,000 people in 1940, just before Jim's birth. Now up over 100,000 people, home of Sony Interactive since 2016, makers of the PlayStation. The area was home of the Ramatush people prior to Spanish colonization. The area was referred to as the Rancho de las Pulgas, literally the Ranch of the Fleas, and the Rancho San Mateo. Now, the San Mateo housing market is one of the most expensive in the country. In February 2018, the median San Mateo home value was $1.5 million. A very different place when Jim was growing up, but his family lived comfortably running that grocery store. Fregosi played every sport that he could sign up for growing up. His dad's market even sponsored the Little League team, the Fregosi Market 9, which is a fantastic name for a Little League team. And Jim went to Junipero Serra High School, a Catholic college prep school in San Mateo. Pretty good alumni list. Big sports names, Barry Bonds, Tom Brady, Lynn Swan. Big name in 1980s baseball card collecting, Greg Jeffries. Also a titan in the grocery game, John Shields, who was the CEO of Trader Joe's from 1987 to 2001. All were Serra grads. Fregosi was the first of the school's sports stars. He won 11 varsity letters, all league in football, basketball, baseball, also running sprints, jumping for the track team. He set a school record and perhaps a state record with a long jump of 23 feet, 8 inches. And that record was later broken by Lynn Swan. So just a tremendous athlete coming out of Serra High School. He was named the Peninsula Athlete of the Year. And after high school, he was looking at college options to play football, but the Red Sox came along with a better offer to play baseball.
That's right. Scout Charlie Walgren, who scouted the Bay Area for 40 years from 1946 to 1986, first for the Red Sox, then for the Orioles, made an offer, $20,000 to sign for the Red Sox, which adjusted for inflation today would be $200,000. So a really strong offer for this top high school athlete. And he took it. He went to the Red Sox affiliate in Alpine, Texas. He was only 18 years old, but he played well in his first year, hitting .267, six homers and seven triples. He was 6 feet tall, 170 pounds. He and the Red Sox didn't realize that he was still growing, but he was.
After a decent first year, the Red Sox left him unprotected in the expansion draft. So there were the Washington Senators and Los Angeles Angels were coming into the league. They got to pick 61 selections to fill up their rosters. And Fregosi spent the winter in San Mateo. While he was there, Angels GM Bill Rigney saw him play, liked what he saw. Also, George Genovese, whose name seems to come up in every episode, scouted for the Giants at the time, but was friendly with Rigney and told him, this boy has got a chance to go all the way. And the Angels made Fregosi the 35th pick in the expansion draft.
The Angels system didn't have as much competition as Boston did, so Jim went straight to AAA and got called up to the big leagues for 11 games as a 19-year-old. And then in 1962, he wanted the starting spot at shortstop, but ended up back at AAA. In July of that year, he was called up for good and finished the year playing 58 games and hitting .291.
Mark, anything interesting about these early Angels teams? Were expansion teams at the time expected to be as dire as those in the 90s were in their early seasons?
Well, the interesting thing to remember about the 1961 expansion draft is that it had never happened before. So no one really knew what to expect. There was no sense of how good is this team going to be, et cetera. The other thing that's interesting about it, and actually a little bit horrifying if you think back, is that the American League announced they were going to expand in like October of 1960. Okay, so just a matter of weeks before spring training was going to start. They picked the expansion cities. Then they had to find owners. They literally didn't have owners yet. Okay, so they got owners and then they had to put together this expansion draft. First, they had to make up what the rules would be, like how many people you protect. in the once we get to expansion in the 90s, teams could spend a couple of years jockeying their roster so that the right people were available or not available. They didn't have any rules for that. Nobody expected this was going to be coming. I'm guessing the Red Sox were surprised that the Angels took Fregosi because I think they thought of him as a guy that they liked and they wanted to keep themselves. And I think the Angels were very unusual because in their second season, 1962, they came in third place, which nobody really saw coming. It ended up being a little bit of a fluke. I'm not sure they were really that good. And they were never really bad, but they were never really that good either. They tended to win 75 games for the first 15 years they were around.
But coming off that successful, somewhat, first season where Jim was there in 1962 with that team that finished in third place, he went on a run where he was the best shortstop in baseball from 1963 to 1970. And over that run, he was valued at 45 wins above replacement. And the next best shortstop during that period was Louis Aparicio at 29. So just head and shoulders above the next best player. We'll include a stat head search to shortstops by war from 1963 to 1970. And I guess to level set, if you look at his stats, just raw numbers from 1963 to 1970, it's not like he was A-Rod. He wasn't hitting 40 home runs a season. He was hitting 270, 15 home runs maybe, but he was still much better getting on base than most of the other players in the league. Mark, what was the average 1960 shortstop like? And what was Jim Fregosi like in comparison? What kind of player was he that set him apart from the rest of the pack?
A couple things to keep in mind. One is that 1963 to 1968 was like a dead ball era where they increased the strike zone dramatically in 1963, partially or maybe even completely, because of Roger Maris hitting 61 home runs. I think there was sort of this sense that it's too easy now. Hitters are way ahead. This turns out that it wasn't actually true. Like if people had looked at the raw numbers, they'd realize that like the home runs per game really weren't up at all. It's just Roger Maris had a good year. But anyway, they overreacted. It was just a very, very difficult time to hit. So therefore you could get a lot of value by hitting the way Jim Fregosi hit. The other thing that made Fregosi really valuable and the reason why his war is higher than you would think looking at his numbers is that shortstops in the 1960s simply could not hit. And this was largely because teams valued defense almost completely as the sole determinant of the shortstop that they wanted. It was unusual to see any shortstop or second baseman for that matter who could hit. Usually, if you came up as a middle infielder and you could hit, they would move you to the outfield because they say, well, you're a hitter. Obviously, you're not an infielder. And the typical shortstop, I mean, the St. Louis Cardinals were probably the best team in the mid-60s. They had Dal Maxville as their shortstop, and Dal Maxville really couldn't hit. And they won two world titles with him. So there was certainly a sense that people had that it didn't matter. You know, if you had a couple of spots in the lineup, that you simply just didn't care about offense, that was okay as long as you had good defenders. You know, I grew up hearing that you need defense up the middle and offense on the corners. Ideally, a good team would have Mark Belanger as your shortstop, and you get Paul Blair as your center fielder, and you get home runs at first and third and left and right. And Fregosi was hitting 280 with 15 home runs at a time when all his competitors were hitting 212 with two home runs. Value is scarcity, and he was a scarce commodity. So even at the time when he was putting up all these war numbers, which no one knew, of course, no one knew that this was true, no one thought that Jim Fregosi was Roberto Clemente, who was putting up those kinds of war numbers, right? Because Roberto Clemente was hitting 350. Whether the Angels were just lucky in the sense that they were smart enough not to make Jim Fregosi a left fielder, or whether they were smart because he was a pretty good defensive player too, they certainly made the right call and he had a really great 8-year run.
By 1964, he's getting noticed. That year he hit 277, 18 home runs, 9 triples. He had a 141 OPS plus, which was the best among shortstops. He had a good eye, could get on base. He took 72 walks. That year he's valued at 7.9 wins above replacement because he also played great defense. And there was an article in Sports Illustrated that called Fregosi a star on the wrong team and said if Fregosi played for the Dodgers instead of the Angels, the city would cast his footprint or his glove print or something in cement outside Grauman's Chinese Theater. He was starting to get noticed. He made his first All-Star appearance that year. Al Kaline called him the best shortstop in baseball. Ernie Banks said he could hit 400 someday. He's getting rave reviews. And at this point, he is still only 22 years old. This was a mediocre Angels team, 82-80, and they played second fiddle to the Dodgers, not just in Los Angeles, but also even playing in Dodger Stadium.
That was a big year for him off the field, too. Jim and his wife Janet had a son, James Jr., and he also built a 33-unit apartment complex along with a few teammates, making him a utility player, I guess, as a shortstop slash landlord.
That's a good investment, probably worth some money nowadays with Los Angeles real estate prices. The next three seasons, 65-67, were all 5+ war seasons, all-star caliber seasons. He was excellent over that stretch, averaged 273, 12 home runs, 7 triples, 25 doubles, made 2 all-star games, got MVP votes all three seasons, including a 7th place finish in 1967 when he also won his first gold glove. He was the highest paid shortstop in baseball at that time, making $40,000 a year. He also dealt with some weight fluctuations, but he came back and committed himself to a workout regimen and got himself in playing shape, playing at an all-star level each season. 1968, the year of the pitcher, Fregosi's average dropped to 244, but the entire American League was hitting 230. He still had 13 triples, played in the all-star game, for a 95-loss Angels team. 1969, he made a 5th All-Star game and had a sore knee throughout the season, but played through it, I think played 161 games that year, even while injured. 1970 would be the end of that great run and also his final All-Star season at 28 years old. This was a competitive Angels team. Fregosi hit 278 with a career-high 22 home runs. Doesn't seem like much, but it was a team high and the 6th best home run season for a shortstop over that late 60s to 1970 run. That season, the Angels got as close as 3 games back in late August, but they faded. Fregosi was getting MVP buzz, at least from his manager, who said if they win the division, he's going to be the MVP. But as September came around, the Angels fell off, finished 3rd with an 86-76 record that year.
Owner Gene Autry then suggests that Fregosi could be a player manager, perhaps after seeing his manager blow the shot at the playoffs. This statement didn't sit well with the current manager, Lefty Phillips. Gene Autry said, "I don't mean it will happen next year, but I do think it would be good for baseball."
In 1971, California is expected to compete again, but it turned out to be a rough year for Jim and for the Angels. In the offseason, the Angels had acquired Tony Conigliaro in a trade, and he ended up retiring mid-season amid injuries and mental health issues. They also had problems with all-star outfielder Alex Johnson, who was suspended, benched, and there was just team unrest around Alex Johnson. Fregosi missed significant playing time with injuries, playing only 107 games, and having really the worst full season of his career to that point.
I've written about the 1971 Angels before because I think it's probably one of the more disastrous baseball seasons a team has ever had. There was true optimism because, like you said, they won 86 games and they picked up Conigliaro. They also picked up Ken Berry to play center field. It seemed like the perfect addition. They got Jim Maloney, who'd been a good pitch with the Reds. And it really seemed like they had a few holes. They patched those few holes. I think a lot of people thought that they would be the next team in the AL West. The Johnson story is just a complete disaster. He had won the batting title in 1970. He always had some demons. It's almost hard even years later to even understand exactly what was going on with Johnson, but he had periods where he would just start screaming at people for what seemed like no reason. He had lots of problems with being suspended and fined even before 1971, even when he was, you know, seemingly playing well on the field. That season, he was suspended a bunch of times. And then there was a time that Chico Ruiz, who was a good friend of his, actually pulled a gun on him in the locker room. Apparently, a lot of people had guns in California because Autry was, of course, an old cowboy. He had a lot of guns. He would give people guns as gifts. So there were a lot of guns around. Whether Ruiz's gun was loaded, I'm not sure. But there was a lot of anger in the clubhouse Fregosi, who was theoretically the leader, had legit injury problems. So he had, like you said, a particularly bad season. But by the end, the manager had to be fired. The GM was fired. Johnson was traded. And like the whole thing just imploded. They basically traded their most popular player, who was Jim Fregosi.
In December 1971, Jim is sent in a trade that would in some ways overshadow all of his achievements as an Angel and make him a historical answer to a trivia question, as he was sent to the New York Mets for three minor leaguers who didn't end up doing much in the majors: Frank Estrada, Don Rose, Leroy Stanton, and a 25-year-old pitcher named Nolan Ryan. Mark, at the time, did this trade seem as lopsided as it does now?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. From the Mets' point of view, they had a lot of young pitchers who were good, better than Ryan, in fact. Tom Seaver, certainly, Jerry Kuzman. And I think that Ryan was just like another guy. And he was a guy that had a lot of promise. He threw hard. He struck out a lot of people. He wasn't a regular in the rotation ever. He was a spot starter kind of guy, but he was wild. He had this raw talent about him. And there are pitchers that have come along since him, like, I don't know if you guys remember Bobby Witt Sr., who was a guy who pitched and he threw smoke and, you know, put it together a little bit. I think, honestly, if you look at Bobby Witt Sr. and Nolan Ryan at the same ages, like, it isn't obvious which one of them would turn out to be Nolan Ryan. I mean, he clearly had promise and enough so that people wanted him. And then Fregosi, I don't think people understood sort of aging the way we now understand it. A guy mid-career who has a bad year, I think there's always this sense that, like, well, it's a bad year. And, like, he's going to return to being the old Jim Fregosi. This was unusual. The Mets had a long history. They never had a third baseman. Every year they'd try something else. They traded Amos Otis to the Royals a couple years earlier for Joe Foy, and it was because they wanted a third baseman desperately. And Foy didn't work out, so then a year later they traded Ryan for Fregosi. The intention was to play him at third base. And it couldn't have possibly gone worse for the New York Mets because they essentially sold Ryan low and they bought Fregosi high. There was never a moment after that where Fregosi was anywhere near as good as Ryan. But before that, there was never a moment that Ryan was as good as Fregosi. They just flipped.
As you said, the Mets had a problem at third base. They wanted to put Fregosi there. They had used 45 players in 10 years at third base, and they would need to use some more because it didn't work out with Fregosi. He had injuries, a thumb injury in spring training. He was learning a new position, a new league with new bat, with new pitchers that he's playing against, new stadiums, a new home stadium, and he was enjoying life in New York City. He said, "I was leading the good life and I loved it, but I was paying for it on the field." And he hit in two seasons, 233 in 146 games. So really not even playing full seasons. And after 2 years, the Mets gave up and sold him to the Rangers in the middle of 1973. He was better at first for Texas. Meanwhile, Nolan Ryan won 40 games in his first two seasons, set the strikeout record with 383 in 1973. He would stick around California for eight seasons, winning 138 games. And in hindsight, this trade just looks awful.
Fregosi ended up playing parts of four seasons for the Rangers. He was okay in 1974, hitting .261 with 12 homers, but it was only in 253 at-bats. He only played in 78 games. Injuries and performances limited him to only 271 more games over parts of five seasons. He was traded to the Pirates in 1977, was a pinch hitter and a backup in 77 and 78, and was released June 1st, 1978, and that was the end of his playing days. So closing the book on Jim Fregosi, 18 seasons in the major leagues, a .265 average, 151 home runs, 78 triples, and a career OPS plus of 113. He was a six-time All-Star and had one gold glove. How about in retirement?
The fun story about his retirement is this is owner collusion at the highest level here. Gene Autry calls Pittsburgh and says, "Can you release Jim Fregosi so I can hire him to be my manager?" And that was how his playing career ended. One career in baseball leads right into the next. He's 36 years old and went to the Angels, who had started strong that season and then lost a few games in a row to finish May in third place. after which Gene Autry fires Dave Garcia and says, "Garcia was a dandy guy, but he was too quiet. Jimmy is a scrapper, a go-getter. I felt he would be someone the players would respect." That's a good Gene Autry talk. Jim's first game in charge was June 2nd, and this team had Brian Downing, Don Baylor, Bobby Grich, Frank Tanana, and Nolan Ryan. So it comes full circle. The Angels went 62-54 with Jim in charge to finish in second place.
In 1979, the Angels added Rod Carew to that already good lineup, and Fregosi led the Angels to the postseason for the first time in their history. The team won 88 games. Don Baylor was the MVP, but unfortunately, they lost the ALCS 3-1 to the Orioles.
In 1980, with Nolan Ryan going to Houston, the Angels' fortunes dropped precipitously, winning only 65 games. Going into 1981, Gene Autry spent big, adding Fred Lynn and some other players to that team. They started slow, and Fregosi was fired with a 22-25 record, replaced by Gene Mauch, who continued all the way into the 1988 set. Fregosi went on to manage AAA Louisville for a couple seasons. That Louisville team was in the Cardinals system, so in his 3.5 seasons there, he managed a bunch of guys who would make up the core of the Cardinals World Series teams: Andy Van Slyke, Danny Cox, Todd Worrell, Vince Coleman, Terry Pendleton, Jose Aquindo. The team was successful both on the field as well as with the fans. They set minor league attendance records and won two league titles. And then in the middle of 1986, the White Sox decided to fire Tony La Russa after a slow start. Hawk Harrelson decided he would go with Jim Fregosi. Compared to his time in California, Fregosi said that he had learned a lot, particularly about handling a pitching staff, and also that he had grown up a bit. He said, "In those days, I thought I was a hotshot. Some things I didn't know how to handle. Let's just say I've paid my dues. There's nothing I can't handle now." So, Mark, anything about Fregosi's management style or anything that we should know about him as Jim Fregosi, the manager?
You know, I don't really have a lot of insight into Fregosi as a manager, other than I think in his early days, he was kind of more one of the guys. I think he was 36 when he started managing. He was not a disciplinarian because he wasn't particularly, you know, he did not live the life of a choir boy himself. And I don't mean that to sound derogatory. I think he was out, you know, at the bar, and I think he was smoking a lot of cigarettes, and he was just a jock. You know, that's ultimately what Fregosi was his whole life, as a jock. And we've, you know, we've all known jocks, and we know if you get a bunch of jocks in a room, Fregosi was the leader of that. I think he was largely hired because people thought he was gritty and tough and hard-nosed and old school. He was very old school. Even when he was young, he was old school. So I think he's the kind of manager you don't really see anymore, a guy that is largely hired because he was a tough guy. The kind of guy that if it was a fight broke out, he'd probably run out of the dugout. That kind of sort of emotional leader. And I think, you know, when he won with the Phillies, you know, they had basically had one good year while he was there, and that was the year that they won. And, you know, what do you think about when you think about that team? Lenny Dykstra, Darren Dalton. I mean, there were all these guys that were just, you know, jocks. They were dudes, you know, that had the long hair, and probably you wouldn't want to get them mad at you in a bar. And that's the kind of guy Fregosi probably loved.
An old school, scrappy guy. I can picture Hawk Harrelson saying that's just what this White Sox team needed. But I could also see their performance leading a person to be grumpy. And he inherited a boring White Sox team. They were 27-39. They had Fisk and Baines, but other than that, they had a lot of underperforming guys. Fregosi did slightly better than La Russa that first season, but the team still lost 90 games. 87 and 88, they weren't any better. They finished in fifth place both those seasons, under 500. Bad teams, bad vibe in Chicago with rumors of the team leaving town. In 1988, Fregosi did get a chance to show off his acting chops in this commercial for the White Sox upcoming season.
The White Sox are looking forward to a great season. We've got a good combination of youth and experience. Our guys are working hard this offseason to stay sharp. And so am I! How can you miss that call? He was safe! He was under the tag! What's wrong with you? Are you crazy, you big dummy, you? You can't kick me out because I'm leaving anyway! See, I'm in mid-season form already.
This shows Fregosi practicing his ejection technique. He had been tossed 5 times the previous season, but in 1988, only once. So this was foreshadowing. Maybe he needed more practice. Maybe he had practiced too much. He got tired.
Yeah, maybe he just needed a break because he was fired after the 88 season and took a couple years out of the big leagues, but then was hired back to manage the Phillies. His first couple seasons there, it looked like it would be similar to his time with the White Sox with win totals in the 70s. And this was a team that hadn't been in the playoffs since 1983. But Mark, as you mentioned, this was a team coming up in 1993 that had that scruffy character that seemed to fit the Fregosi mold.
The Macho Row Phillies won 97 games with John Kruk, Darren Dalton, Lenny Dykstra. They won the NL East. Fregosi was credited with not restraining the Phillies' diverse personalities and thus for not restraining their play on the field.
Was that a credit from the National HR Association?
Diverse personalities.
Right. That's a good way to put it, yeah.
Fregosi turned up his own personality. He got ejected 7 times, a career high. A couple interesting ones as described by Retro Sheet. He was arguing a catch that was called a trap. I watched an 8-minute video of Jim Fregosi getting thrown out of games. This was definitely a catch that he got thrown out on. They called it a trap. He was arguing about a batting order. I did not see the video of this one, but...
My completely unscientific view is that if Fregosi got kicked out only 1 time in 88 versus 5 times in 87, he might have checked out a little bit. You know, my team isn't working. And I think when you get to 93, suddenly he's like, hey, this is working. I want in on this. And he's going to be out there because every game matters.
And that personality fit with this team well and led them to the World Series. In the NLCS against Atlanta, they lost 2 of the first 3 games and then won 3 straight to win the series. In that NLCS, Mitch Williams, the closer, blew 2 saves, but the Phillies ended up winning both of those games. And then in the World Series, Fregosi, he was a guy for his guys. He stuck with Mitch Williams. And in Game 4, down 2 games to 1, Fregosi went to Williams with a 14-10 lead in the 8th inning. And Wild Thing blew the save and took the loss in that game. Phillies win the next game, Game 5. It's 3 games to 2 going into Game 6. Could be decisive. And they take a lead into the 9th inning. Bottom of the 9th, Game 6. And Fregosi gave Mitch Williams the ball. And we know what happened next. After allowing a walk and a single, Wild Thing gives up a Joe Carter home run to end the game and the series. But Fregosi stood by that decision. 20 years after the game, he said, loyalty is the biggest thing in the game. Without Mitch Williams, we would never have got to that point. Mitch Williams gave all he could to this organization and our team. You don't get to a certain stage, get to the 6th game of the World Series and say that you are going to bleep can that guy. I'm not going to do that. And we could question it, but the Phillies lost the World Series. That was the only time that Fregosi made it to the World Series as a manager, and they lost. Fregosi and the Phillies couldn't repeat that magic. In the next 3 seasons, they never finished over 500. He was fired after a 95-loss season in 1996. He worked in the Giants front office for a little while, was hired by the Blue Jays for a couple seasons, finishing a couple games over 500 both seasons, then was hired by the Braves to work as a special assistant to their GM and their top scout. In 2010, he was awarded the Professional Baseball Scout Foundation George Genovese Award for Excellence in Scouting. And during that time with Atlanta, he also interviewed for a few managerial positions, but was never hired for those. His managerial record in 15 seasons was 1,028 wins and 1,094 losses.
In February of 2014, while on a Major League Baseball alumni cruise, Fregosi suffered multiple strokes and was airlifted from the Cayman Islands to Miami, where he was taken off life support and passed away 12 hours later with his wife Joni at his side. He passed away February 14th at the age of 71, and he had spent 53 years in baseball. How do we think about the legacy of Jim Fregosi in baseball? What was the Hall of Fame vote for him?
In 1984, in his first year of eligibility, he got 4 votes. That was 1%, not enough to keep him on the ballot for a second year. Looking at Adam Dorowski's Hall of Stats, Jim Fregosi's score was 93, so falls a little bit below the 100 level that would signify just statistically a Hall of Fame player. He was inducted into the National Italian American Sports Hall of Fame, located here in Chicago, Illinois. And Jim's number 11 was retired by the Angels. He was the second player in team history to have that honor after Bobby Gritch, perhaps another underappreciated shortstop for the Angels, underappreciated by Hall of Fame voters, that is. And Jim remains third on the Angels' wins above replacement leaderboard behind only Mike Trout and Chuck Finley. And he's top 10 still in the franchise in games played, offensive war, defensive war, hits, runs, total bases, triples, doubles, RBIs, and walks.
Mark, how do you think that his record as a player first stacks up against Hall of Fame credentials?
I think Fregosi has, you know, 2/3 of a Hall of Fame career, and that's fantastic. He's better than just about any, you know, 98% of the people that have ever played. I don't think he's a Hall of Famer. You can compare him to Bobby Gritch, but Bobby Gritch had 50% longer of a career, and so did Whitaker. I think he'd be a person that we'd all be fighting about had he continued playing. If his aging was a little more gentle than it was, if he'd played another, say, 3 or 4 years as a good player. He never really had that good player phase. He went from a 5 WAR player to a 0 WAR player, almost like in the blink of an eye. And he needed a gentler off-ramp, I think, to his career. And had he done that, I think he might not make the Hall of Fame even with that, but he'd be a person that many people would be advocating for. He would have a career that nerds would appreciate. A lot of his greatness, and I think it was greatness, was masked at the time by the era that he played in, the ballpark he played in, both Dodger Stadium, which is where he started, and then Angel Stadium, both very difficult parks to hit in. So he had a lot of stuff going against him there. He had good stats that were really great stats, I think. So I think that that would keep him from being, you know, a guy that writers would be clamoring for. But I think a lot of people would be arguing for him. He's certainly better than Bill Mazeroski or somebody that was not quite a peer, but they overlapped probably half their careers. He's not Alan Trammell or Lou Whitaker, because he had Alan Trammell, Lou Whitaker years, 8 of them, but that's his career, right? He had 8 great seasons, and that was basically his career. I think he's a very good player, and one of my goals in life as a baseball fan / raconteur is to appreciate the very good players, or even the good players, or even the bad player. I mean, everybody that makes the major leagues deserves to be appreciated, and Fregosi was better than almost all of them. I don't think he rises to the Hall of Fame tier, though.
Well, that's exactly the point of this podcast, I think, is to give everybody their due. As you said, his peak war and those 7 peak seasons, he was valued at 41 wins above replacement in those peak 7 years. That's similar to the peaks of Barry Larkin, Ozzie Smith, Derek Jeter. But unlike those guys, unlike Bobby Gritch, he didn't have 10 more seasons that were of similar value. And that peak was 41 wins above replacement. His career was 48. So the rest of his career was basically as a replacement level player after 1970. On the strength of those early seasons, among all shortstops, he is 25th still, just with that very early, that great, very early career, ahead of Jimmy Rollins, Miguel Tejada, Omar Vizquel, very good players, some of whom get Hall of Fame consideration. When we look at the stats, counting stats are not that impressive, but in his prime, comparatively, he was outstanding compared to the other shortstops at the time. As a manager, and I know sometimes a player can get a bump in Hall of Fame consideration if they have a great career as a manager, he had an average career. He was under 500 as a manager, never won a World Series. Maybe if that 93 team, which I think is fondly remembered by Phillies fans, if they had finished the deal, he might have gotten some consideration. He was a good motivator, respected as a player, and then because of that, rolled into a respected coaching position. At that time, it was players that he played with, maybe played against, had been traded for, that he was trying to motivate. And then as he aged, his colorful antics, I think, showed and helped that Phillies team, at least, and allowed the personality of that team to flourish, a team that could have imploded like that early Angels team with all of those big personalities. but instead they gelled and Fregosi let it happen. I think Fregosi as a guy seemed a little bit surly, but also willing to have a little bit of a sense of humor, consider himself part of the joke, at least be in on the joke of himself with that manager rage. But also, maybe as a joke, maybe this is a sense of humor, or maybe he was being serious about his quality as a player. In 2001, he was talking with Canadian Baseball Network's Bob Elliott as Barry Bonds is on his way to 73 homers. And they're talking about, you know, they both shared an alma mater. And Fregosi said, Barry Bonds is probably, I say probably, the second best athlete ever to wear the uniform of the Serra Padres. And Fregosi said, who is the best? Well, I was. He was an amazing athlete as a young person, could have played football, baseball, multi-sport athlete, long jumper, and was able to carry that sense of humor and that pride in his accomplishments all the way into 2001, comparing himself with a guy who was having one of the greatest baseball seasons ever, perhaps with an asterisk or not. But Jim Fregosi, perhaps underrated player due to some of those counting stats, maybe not quite a Hall of Famer, but a very good career.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing I would say about this podcast that I appreciate is that I think that one thing we forget is like all of these guys were star players their whole lives before they got signed. You know, so the guys that you hardly even remember from this set, they probably pitched and played shortstop and batted cleanup on their high school team. So they were used to sort of all the perks of that. I always think of baseball as this sort of pyramid. And I was on that pyramid because I played in high school. So I'm like, I don't know what, the second rung up. And there's like 10 more rungs, right? And I think like everybody, they play until the game tells them that they can't play anymore. And in my case, I was 18. In Barry Bonds' case, maybe it hasn't happened yet. Fregosi made it longer than most people. Six All-Star teams. I mean, who wouldn't want that career? I mean, it's great.
A leader on the field, a colorful manager, a great story, and a great biography. And thank you, Mark, so much for sharing your writing, but also then coming and sharing your voice with us today. We really appreciate it. Are there any projects that you would like to plug here or other places that you would encourage listeners to find your work?
If I'm going to plug anything, since my book is a year old, the thing I would probably plug to your listeners, if they haven't already jumped aboard, I really urge everyone to join Sabre. It's something that I joined when I was fresh out of college, which was a long time ago. I've met many of my closest friends through Sabre. We don't just sit around and talk baseball all the time. That's sort of how you meet people. But you know, you find out that a lot of these people that like baseball also like the same movies you do, and they like the same restaurants you do, and they like the same beer you do. And there's all kinds of other things you find from joining any kind of organization of enthusiasts, I guess. If you love baseball, I guarantee you there are people in Sabre that love baseball the same way that you love baseball. And it isn't that difficult to find those people. We are busy trying to explain baseball to everybody that we can. We're all sort of promoters, even though we don't think of it that way. And we could use the help. So if there are any of your listeners out there that aren't on board, the Baseball Cards Committee is fantastic. I was involved in it at the start. Now I'm just a fan of it, but it's great. So yeah, that's my plug, Sabre, sabre.org.
Fantastic. We appreciate that. And we'll have a link for that in the show notes. Thank you, Mark, again, very much for joining us today. And thank you to you at home. Whether you are a baseball nerd or a baseball jock, we'd love to hear from you on Twitter. We're at Topps1988. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.